Buddha the Dharma. I've been quoting a famous line of the sixth ancestor, Wing Nang or Daikon Inno: "There is nothing from the first," that River Master so often said as well. And I thought that I'd do a kind of a footnote talk where I talked about this famous story of the two poems, and it's in Weening's famous poem that that line occurs: "There's nothing from the first." So the story is, of course, that when Wing Nang was a lay trainee in his early 20s in the monastery of the fifth patriarch, the fifth patriarch, I guess, was coming to the end of his life and looking for his successor. And he told the monks to compose a poem, and he would choose a successor from amongst those who produced the best poem, meaning the deepest teaching. This does not strike me as historically accurate, but it makes a good story, you know, and I've read things that people say that's, you know, not historically accurate. And it doesn't strike me as historically accurate. There's more going on here than meets the eye anyway. Let's put it that way. But I could see where the master might use something like this as a means of trying to flush someone out of the woodwork or something. I don't know. So anyway, we'll just take it at face value and go on. It was a long time ago. And the teaching is what matters in these things, not the historical accuracy. The teaching here is really important teaching. So it said that the chief disciple wrote a poem, wrote it on a wall, I guess. And his famous poem also, it goes like this: "Our body is the Bodhi tree, and our mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour and let no dust alight." That's someone who's understood a lot about training, clearly. And yet there's something missing. And the text doesn't leave it for you to guess as to there's something missing. The text is it says that the patriarch knew that the chief monk had not entered the door of enlightenment and that he had not realized his true nature. In this translation, what I'm calling true nature, which is the way it should be translated, is called essence of mind, with a capital M. It says there's some very awkward things in this. This is, I think, Luke's translation here, who's an excellent, excellent translator. But some of his English is awkward, and it should be its true nature. That's what the better way of translating it, because it reverberates more deeply with a native English speaker. Charles Look was not, I believe, a native English speaker. At any rate, it's an excellent translation, and I don't mean to be critical. It's an excellent, excellent translation. And I'm altering things a little bit. So it it says the fifth patriarch knew that the chief monk had not realized his true nature as yet. His poem shows very sincere training. And shows a certain level of understanding. And it's still walking spiritually. It's not flying. So it's said that Wei Ming read this poem. All the other monks were kind of, they thought it was a shoe-in for the chief monk, so they didn't even try. They didn't even write a poem. But Wei Ming read this poem, and he wrote his own poem. Remember, he was just a lay person at the time. And his poem said, "The body is not the Bodhi tree, the mind is not the mirror bright. Since there is nothing from the first, where can the dust alight?" And that's where the line, "There's nothing from the first," comes from. And this is not Charles Lick's translation, though. This is another translation than the one River Master used, and the one I like best. And this is not just walking, it's flying spiritually. We need to talk a little bit about what the difference is here. The problem, such as it is, and I wouldn't want to overdo it as to what the problem is on that first poem, because it's quite excellent, it's quite good. But there's a problem with it, and that is, you know, you don't actually need the eternal in that. That's a simple way to put it. In other words, there's too much of me in it still, even though very sincere me, sincere effort me. There's too much of the person in it, and it hasn't got to the point where the person has disappeared and there is just the unborn. The body is the Bodhi tree, the mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour, and let no dust alight. That's being very vigilant in one's training. That's applying meditation and the precepts very carefully. And if you just kind of, my instinctive reaction to that, and say your instinct is accurate, is it's kind of a little straitjackety. It's a little close in. Like, that's all fine up to a point, but when are you going to really let go and fly? Because there's, you know, it's like we got to keep in control here. Got to keep the self under control. And yes, you do always need to be vigilant about the self. That's true. The master said, you know, every morning I have breakfast with Mara, and when I do, I eat with a long-handled spoon. You know, with a long-handled spoon, you can sit back away from the table a bit and get your food. You know, I don't have to sit too, you don't get too close in there with Mara, because Mara represents, you know, delusion. That which keeps us on our toes. And there's more to the spiritual life than keeping on your toes and guarding yourself. There's the greater part of the spiritual life. And it's that greater part that Wei Ning nailed right between the eyes with his poem. The body is not the Bodhi tree. The mind is not a mirror bright. Since there is nothing from the first, where can the dust alight? Now, what is a Western equivalent of that there is nothing from the first? It's the nada nada of St. John of the Cross. Nada is Spanish for nothing. The nothing, nothing of St. John of the Cross. And what is the Buddhist explanation of the nothing, nothing of St. John of the Cross? You know, the Scripture of Great Wisdom, the Heart Sutra. Not this, not this, not this. Not even the Eightfold Path, remember? Not the accumulation of merit. In other words, the point of the religious life is not the perfecting of ourselves. That's not the point of the religious life. The point of the religious life is the transcendence of self. And what can the transcendence of self possibly mean? What can it possibly mean? It can't have a meaning relating to self or to any externalized goal or object or experience. It's beyond all of that. What is beyond all of that? What is beyond everything? All that's left is the Buddha nature itself. Since the Buddha nature itself cannot be realized through thought or through feeling, cannot be intellectually comprehended or understood, cannot be grasped, how is it that we can have any knowledge or experience of it at all? Well, the answer is simple. When the nada nada, the nothing nothing, goes all the way to the nothing matters, when there is a full acceptance that there is no external answer to the problem of suffering, when then one, in that place of no thingness, when one looks up and lets go, then there it is. There it is. That's not theory. That's not intellectual understanding. That's not emotion. It is experience beyond anything we can describe. It is simply surrendering to the infinite. And when one surrenders to the infinite and one finds oneself in the hand of the infinite, when one surrenders and finds oneself repossessed, reclaimed by love beyond our wildest dreams, then that's it. The fifth patriarch recognized from Wei Ning's poem, and of course, it's not like he didn't know that there was this kid down in the kitchen, you know, which is where he was working. He was pounding the rice, I think, down in the kitchen. It's not like he didn't know that there was this person there. But he knew that here's someone who's actually found it. Another way of speaking of that surrender, of course, is getting, Rev. Master Mokin likes to call it getting kicked out of the driver's seat. The poem of the sixth patriarch, Wei Ning's poem, is completely non-driver's seaty. Inherent in it is the not my will but thine. The losing everything, the giving up everything, and discovering that one is of the entire universe. River Master called that nothingness. She said it's the greatest nothingness you could ever imagine. She also called it the immaculacy of nothingness. And of course, in truth, No matter how much any of us spouts words about it, the words don't convey it. We have to actually ourselves do the letting go, the offering up, the giving up everything, the going willingly to the place of the nothing matters, and in that place looking up rather than down, to fully know what is being talked about. The two poems together make a more complete teaching. And there was a very strong need felt by some in the early days of Chinese Zen to strongly emphasize the giving up everything side of things. So that, and this is my interpretation, by the way, so I subject like any other interpretation, I could be a little off the mark here, but I think this was done, this emphasis was placed so strongly there and needed to be placed there so that people could break out of the point, break away from and out of the point of view that enlightenment can only be the result of this long accumulation of merit, and that ordinary people in this lifetime don't have much of a chance of really experiencing their true nature and really living from that place of the certainty of their true nature, and really reharmonizing with their true nature, that it's out of the reach of most people, and it's for a special few who have done enough accumulation merit over many lifetimes that they finally hit the jackpot in one lifetime. And the Zen movement was saying, no, if we actually give up the scholarly intellectual approach, we stop, you know, translating, reading, studying. Stop doing the kind of formal ceremonies. Just knuckle down, work, meditate, and above all, believe in our own capacity in this lifetime, today, you know, to realize the truth. Then it will be possible that the block is one that we're creating in our own minds, not one that exists in reality. Now the story that I've just condensed down is in the Platform Sutra, the Sutra of Wei Ning. And there's a lot more to this book than just that story. It begins with a little autobiographical chapter, and it goes on to chapters on repentance, on temperament and circumstances, on the sudden school and the gradual school. This is Wei Ning's teaching, is the fundamental teaching of the sudden school and all the Zen schools, or sudden schools. Um, So what the teaching gets rounded out here, that it's, you can't just have a kind of a, well, there's nothing from the first, so I don't have to do anything. See? If there's nothing from the first, well, why wouldn't you train yourself? There's another way to put it. Since there is the eternal, why wouldn't one live in such a way as to harmonize fully with the eternal in this lifetime? It's important also to understand that this teaching was not invented by the early Zen monks. There's nothing in the whole history of Buddhism that wasn't explicitly or implicitly there, right in the Buddha's own experience, in the Buddha's own teaching. Many years ago, when someone donated a copy of the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, this is one of the Mahayana Sutras. It's a Mahayana Sutra that gives the Mahayana version of the teaching given by the Buddha at the time of his death. It's in several, it's like, was it three volumes? Anyone? I think it might be as many as three volumes. This is long. It's really long. And it's thick volumes. Anyway, I happened to be with her master when she received a very generous donation from someone. And her master handed it over to me and said, well, you might be interested in taking a look at it. And I opened it. And I just happened to open it to a place in the first volume where it said, to truly penetrate the teaching of no self is to realize the true self. To truly penetrate the teaching of changeableness is to realize the truth of the unchanging. To truly penetrate the teaching of suffering is to realize peace or contentment, fulfillment. And that's the only thing I know from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, but it may well be a teaching that's worth the whole rest of it, because it's a wonderful teaching, and that's not something invented in Zen. But you couldn't give a better description, give a better way of stating there is nothing from the first, in other words, than that teaching. To truly penetrate the teaching of no self is to realize the true self. If you remember, and I've used throughout these talks in recent months, I've used How to Grow Lotus Blossom as a reference point. I would draw your attention to the interesting fact that, the very, very important fact, that in the crucial experience described in How to Grow Lotus Blossom, where her master experiences that life of the past life of a tiger, after the memory of this past life had come up fully, been allowed to come up fully, and her master had both embraced what had happened all those many years before her birth in this lifetime, given her compassion and sympathy, sought the help of the Eternal on this big spiritual need left over from that tiger's life. The tiger, as it were, returns back down into her hara, and at a certain point it vanishes. And from that point of vanishing, where that tiger vanished at that point, there then appears, shortly thereafter, what's called the child of the Lord. That vanishing of the tiger before the appearance of the child of the Lord in the Hall of Shadows, in the Hara, that is the disappearance of self. There is nothing from the first. There is no self. That which was this jangle that created the illusion of a fundamental reality within which suffering and strain are caught and enmeshed has dissolved and is experienced as disappearing. Self is an unreality. Clouds in a clear sky. When the clouds dissipate, all that's left is a clear sky. Then there appears the child of the Lord. In other words, the Buddha nature then manifests. Another way you can put it, so as Rim Master so often did, the Eternal can then get a word in edgeways. Because there's not that clamoring need in the way now. There's just the stillness. And a great potentiality. Within that field of potentiality, there appears our own true nature. That vanishing of self is not a destruction of self. There's nothing to destroy. It's just that the Eternal is what is real. Our true nature is not born, it does not die. It is not created, it cannot be destroyed. It is immaculate and is beyond holy and unholy, pure and impure. In the Western world, and it may be worldwide now, I don't know, a view of life as achieved a widespread popularity in which people think of God in an externalized way. The God that's thought of in that externalized way cannot be proved to exist. The problem of evil does not seem to be explicable in terms of a compassionate creator. And so there seems to be no God, and our existence seems to be some kind of trick that's been played on us. We're kind of caught between birth and death for a short time, and during that time we suffer. Death seems to be a kind of meaningless extinction. Birth seems to be a kind of meaningless coming into existence out of nothingness. You might say that this point of view is a kind of negative take on emptiness or voidness or nothingness. But it makes all the difference in the world whether you have a positive take on nothingness or a negative take on nothingness. And they don't come out to the same thing at all. It's not surprising so many people are depressed, because in that view I just gave, I think, a pretty fair picture of, you know, there's nothing to really be happy about. There's things to be desperate about. You can desperately try to enjoy yourself in your short time before you inevitably, you know, die. You can desperately grasp after love. But if you really thought about it, why would you even bother? Because after all, you're just going to die, and you're going to lose everything you love. So wouldn't it be better to play it safe and not try not to love anything? Because at least then you can't love. At least you can't lose what you love. If you go down that road, you know, that's a really depressing point of view. There's a lot of that about. Well, let's take the same facts and look at them in another way. Okay, everything in life is transitory. Everything in existence is transitory. Your body is transitory, your mind is transitory, health is transitory, wealth is transitory, security is transitory. You're born and you die. Suffering is an inexorable, inevitable part of every human being's existence. Everyone suffers. You can't get out of that. Pain is a part of everyone's existence. You can't get out of that. You can't prove by any external means the existence of God. You may never be able to know with your intellect the true nature of reality. And if one looks all those things in the eye, just head on, and accepts them positively, and then sits still in one's own heart, letting go. All of those facts, I mean, what are they telling you? What are they teaching you if you were to take them as teaching? Well, the teaching's so obvious, it's staring everyone in the face, staring every human being in the face all the time. Let go. There's no refuge here. No refuge here. Don't keep pounding on the door here of external things and experiences, transitory things and experiences for a refuge. There is none here. Okay, so there's none here. So where might there be one? Might there still be a refuge somewhere? Well, not everyone is spending all their time running around in their head or out kind of desperately indulging themselves in such a way as to keep themselves kind of anesthetized in one way or another or overexcited emotionally in one way or another. You know, what if one were just actually to be really still and just turn within? When one consciously does that, that's what we call meditation. Perhaps the refuge was somewhere one hasn't been looking. Perhaps the refuge is somewhere one hasn't been looking. Maybe it's just a matter, if you look in the right place, there it was all along. In order to hit the nothing matters, to really hit the full nothing matters, that nada, nada, there's no external refuge. Nada, nada, nothing, nothing. It has to be completely thorough. It has to be incredibly thorough. It has to leave you with nothing. And when you're left with nothing, and sometimes this only happens at the time of death. If you're left with nothing and you just sit still in that place of being left with nothing and look up rather than down, allow your heart to look up rather than down. Don't despair in the face of that there is nothing. Turn within and look up. Be still in your heart. Then that nothing can turn into everything so fast. In an instant, a twinkling of an eye. What is necessary is that we stop insisting that it has to be the way we want it to be. And we accept that it is the way it is. While we keep trying to wring out of external things that which they can never give us, we just pile suffering upon suffering and confusion upon confusion. When we sit still in our own heart, let go, there it is. There it is. There is nothing from the first. That's when there is nothing from the first turns into it is enough for me to know the Lord of the house. It is enough for me to know the Lord of the house. It is enough for me to have the Lord of the house. It is enough for me to be owned by the Lord of the house. Remember, said, to have nothing, to know nothing, to want nothing. That's called spiritual poverty in Western contemplative tradition. It's the same. True mysticism, true contemplative teaching is the same in practice. It's the same everywhere, really. Different forms, maybe, but its heart is the same. It's not unique to Buddhism. To have nothing, to know nothing, to want nothing. What does that mean? I am not the center of the universe. What I want, what I think, is not the center of the universe. If you get down out of God's seat, start bowing, then there it is. One doesn't need God to be a creator. One doesn't need God to be visible to the eyes, available to the senses. One doesn't need external proof of what one knows in one's heart and with one's blood and bones. One doesn't need. It is. That is enough. It is. I am not him, Tozan said. He is all of me. I am not him. He is all of me. I am not him. Get out of God's seat. That's the I am not him. He is all of me. He is a reality. It is a reality. Of you, me, and everything else. This is not something remote and esoteric. It's not something that you have to pile merit upon merit lifetime after lifetime, and one day you'll be good enough for it. You just have to be a suffering human being who sits still and looks up. That's all you need. You don't have to be an extraordinary human being. Funny how we create the standards that we fail to live up to. The Eternal doesn't have any standards like that. Infinite love only knows how to love. Doesn't care the way we are. If we do things that confuse us, we confuse ourselves, which is what happens when we break the precepts, break the true spirit of the precepts. When we go against our heart, we do things that confuse ourselves. Well, if we do things that confuse ourselves, it doesn't matter to the Eternal. If we do things that unconfuse ourselves, which happens when we follow the precepts, we live in accordance with the true spirit of the precepts. We do things in it that unconfuse ourselves. That doesn't matter to the Eternal either. It just matters to us. People who share the point of view that I described is, I think, again, rather well, as a negative kind of existential emptiness, you know. People who have that point of view may be exactly the people who are getting ready for introduction to what the real emptiness is. The wonders of the immaculacy of nothingness. Maybe sometimes people have to go through such a kind of corrosive doubt. Maybe that's something that whole societies go through at times in their preparation, in being prepared for the gift of the Buddha's teaching. I don't know. But it's not a pleasant place to stay for very long. And yet it's a place where if a person will only look up rather than down, a great opportunity opens up. The Dharma, to the Sangha.